Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. According to a 2016 ranking by the Center for Disease Control, the 10 counties in America most at risk for an HIV outbreak are all in central Appalachia. On today's show, we'll explore what's being done to prevent the spread of needle-borne diseases in our region.
There is certainly a sense of urgency knowing the potential out there with HIV and hepatitis C, but there is the same sense of urgency to be responsive to the community and really do what the community needs and wants.
But in West Virginia's capital city, the local health department met opposition for their efforts to try to prevent the spread of hepatitis and HIV through a needle exchange program.
Since we became a mecca for these folks, it wasn't a needle exchange, it was a needle mill.
We'll also hear what it's like for those living here with HIV, oftentimes in secret.
If you can toughen up, you need to share it. Be open about it. That's the problem. If more people were open, then the stigma wouldn't be there.
You'll find these stories and more this week, Inside Appalachia.
Inside Appalachia is supported in part by the West Virginia Food and Farm Coalition, helping West Virginia farmers markets provide food harvested that morning and brought to you fresh from the farm. Local market locations available at farmfreshwv.com.
Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today, we're digging into an increasingly prevalent side effect of the opioid epidemic, the spread of needle-borne diseases like hepatitis and HIV. HIV in particular is often portrayed as a disease that occurs most frequently in big cities like Philadelphia, New York, or San Francisco. Until recently, rural Americans wouldn't typically list it as a top concern in their communities. But perhaps it's no surprise that with increased use of intravenous drugs in Appalachia, perceptions are quickly changing and myths are being busted. Back in 2015, health officials were shocked when a small rural community in southern Indiana saw a massive outbreak of HIV.
The number of HIV infections has jumped from 89 to 135.
Scott County has an HIV epidemic on their hands. The source? Needles shared and reused by drug users.
Indiana's governor at the time, Mike Pence, declared a public health emergency in Scott County, Indiana. When drug users shoot up heroin or crushed and liquefied prescription opioids, they sometimes share needles and unknowingly infect each other. To slow the spread of HIV, the county opened the state's first needle exchange program, a medically accepted practice in which intravenous drug users are given an opportunity to exchange their used and possibly infected needles for clean, new ones. The outbreak in southern Indiana prompted the Centers for Disease Control, or CDC, to launch a major investigation to determine which other American communities might be at a similar risk. They found that the top 10 communities in the country most at risk are in fact right here in central Appalachia, specifically in eastern Kentucky and southern West Virginia. The CDC found places with a combination of high poverty, low access to health care, and rampant IV drug use were the most likely to be at risk for an HIV outbreak, as well as the spread of hepatitis C. We wondered, how are community members in Appalachia coping, and what resources are available to help them prevent the spread of these diseases? People across our region are fighting back against the opioid epidemic and pushing the message of recovery. One strategy is opening a harm reduction clinic, which sometimes includes needle exchanges. According to the West Virginia Department of Health and Human Resources, there are at least 11 harm reduction programs across the state that offer help to people with substance use disorders. And though there is some controversy over the practice of giving free needles to people who use illegal drugs, these programs can get more people into long-term recovery. We originally reported on this issue earlier this year as we explored what some communities in Appalachia are doing to help reduce the spread of HIV and hepatitis. Since then, we've learned about several new programs that have launched in the past year, and we wanted to highlight those. One of these is in the Eastern Panhandle in Berkeley County, West Virginia. Liz McCormick introduces us to a nurse who runs the program.
So these are insulin syringes, and these are the longs.
Angie Gray is the nurse director here at the Berkeley Morgan County Health Department in Martinsburg. She rummages through a box of sealed, sterile needles given to participants in her harm reduction program with syringe or needle exchange access.
I've wanted to be a nurse since second grade. I was just one of those people that always knew what they needed to do.
Gray lives in Morgan County, and every day she drives an hour to where she works in Martinsburg. She's been a nurse for 25 years and worked most of her professional career here in Berkeley County. Just over 1 year ago, she began Berkeley County's first harm reduction program after seeing the devastation from the opioid epidemic in her community.
We've seen this escalating over the last 10 years. Had young kids who were coming in for STD testing and who were using or IV drug users and begging for help, and I had nowhere to send them.
Since Gray started her harm reduction program in April 2017, she says she went from a handful of participants the first couple months to more than 1,000 by the end of its first year. But not everyone supports harm reduction programs. Some people think they only encourage substance use. A similar program in Charleston was suspended this past May by the Charleston mayor over concerns the program was causing an uptick in dirty needles in public places. Gray says concern her program could be shut down too is always in the back of her mind, but says she works closely with local law enforcement to explain the benefits of the program. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports harm reduction programs considerably reduce the spread of disease and do not increase illegal use of drugs. Gray notes the program also offers a bridge to recovery.
If someone's attending a harm reduction program, they're 5 times more likely to seek recovery because they've already made that initial connection. A lot of it is about the relationship building as well, building trust with people, helping them get to a better place in life.
The focus of syringe exchange programs is to help prevent disease or death for people suffering from substance use disorder. Gray provides needle exchange and education about recovery, and it's anonymous. The program never shares patients' information. After Gray started her program, a handful of other Eastern Panhandle counties also began their own. Gray says she thinks her program has been successful because she and her staff treat the patients like people and try to understand where each person is coming from when they use.
So if they're using water out of a public restroom to mix their heroin with to inject into their vein, then that's where I go that day.
She doesn't physically go there with them, but talks out the scenario in the exam room and explains cleaner ways to use if they aren't ready for recovery. So if the patient feels they have to use a public restroom to inject heroin and they don't have access to sterile water,
then remove the back of the tank on the toilet and use the water out of there because that water is cleaner and less potential bacteria in it, you know, so it's reduction of harm.
There's a cap of 40 needles each week Gray and her staff are allowed to hand out. They also include a container for each person to return the dirty needles to the clinic. She teaches her patients how to clean used needles thoroughly until they can exchange for new ones. And some of her patients do enter recovery. More than 100 have reported back saying they entered recovery and are no longer using.
Currently, you're in what we would call our community room. This room was set up
about 2 miles from Gray's clinic is the Berkeley County Recovery Resource Center.
This room here will hold anywhere up to 70 people.
Kevin Knowles runs this place. He's the Community Recovery Service Coordinator for Berkeley County and the president of the West Virginia Recovery Center Resource Association. Knowles works closely with several recovery initiatives in the county, like 12-step programs, detox and rehabilitation centers, and he works with Gray's harm reduction program. In fact, he's helped all of Gray's patients who decided they were ready to enter recovery.
The resource center here, we supply all the peer recovery coaches for that harm reduction, and we've been able to see about 20% of the individuals that go through harm reduction are actually sitting with us, and we're doing some peer recovery coaching, and we're also being able to help them find different services.
About 3 years ago, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation recognized 25 public health nurses around the country who expressed great interest in becoming community health leaders. Nurse Angie Gray was one of them and received 4 weeks of special training in leadership and support in her harm reduction initiative. Gray was the only public health nurse from West Virginia to receive this training. Gray hopes the tools she's learned and shared with her staff will foster more solutions to the opioid epidemic.
I think we'll see impacts of what we're doing in the next 5 or 10 years. As an overall of the community, my silver lining is when we open up the newspaper and there's a death in there of somebody who's under 40, and we don't automatically assume that it's from an opioid overdose. that's my silver lining.
Gray says her next move is to take her harm reduction program on the road so she can meet the needs of more people in rural areas. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Liz McCormick in Martinsburg, West Virginia.
Nurse Angie Gray said she'd like to look into making her program more mobile to reach more people. Now we'll hear about a program that's done just that. The health department in Wyoming County in southern West Virginia is the first health department in the state to take this resource on the road and offer a mobile harm reduction unit. It just started this past spring. The unit includes a traveling needle exchange that allows drug users to get clean needles rather than share them, and hepatitis C and HIV testing. Even though it's a mobile unit, Molly Bourne found out choosing the location is the hardest part.
Fred Cox and his team are setting up on a gravel shoulder off the side of the road, like where you might see someone selling summer vegetables. There's a white tent, a table, some folding chairs, and brown paper bags piled in crates. This is the Wyoming County Health Department's mobile harm reduction unit. It includes a needle exchange.
We park at a wide spot in the road at Allen Junction, and we've made inroads with some of the folks, and a lot of times they're there waiting on us.
It's about 12:30 on a Friday afternoon in July. There's no one here yet, but after a few minutes, a car pulls up and the people inside ask for some supplies. Then a couple comes around the curve in the road and walks up.
Whatever you need.
Oh, okay.
Hold on, you want me to do it?
No,
oh,
I got it. Y'all doing okay?
Yeah, y'all been doing.
They're willing to talk, even to a reporter, about their struggle with addiction.
I have been doing drugs since I was like 18. Quit there for a while, went to rehab, and then relapsed.
That's Rebecca. She's 35. It's her fifth time visiting the van since May.
Nobody had ever done something like this. It's my health, and I want to make sure I stay healthy, even though I'm doing stupid stuff.
She and her fiancé, John, both inject heroin. He's 28. We're using just their first names to protect their privacy.
Now there's nowhere near as many people sharing needles and passing the same needle back and forth for each of them to use.
John says just the night before, a friend overdosed, and he had to revive her with the Narcan spray he got from an earlier visit to the van. He just found out someone he's taken drugs with before is HIV positive. John isn't, but he says he shared needles with the guy several times before the diagnosis.
And if it wasn't for this program, I wouldn't be forced to, because nobody forced me, but I would want to use his needle just so that I could get up. That's how an addict's thinking is. Even though we know they have HIV, I would still use his needle if it wasn't for them giving us clean needles, because I would not want to be sick and hurting.
Wyoming County in southern West Virginia is among a group of counties in central Appalachia that are especially vulnerable to the rapid spread of HIV, partly because of intravenous drug use. The county sees no new HIV cases in most years, Cox says, but last year experienced what he calls a cluster of them. A spokesman for the State Department of Health and Human Resources says it won't give out county-level HIV numbers because there are so few cases. But there were 57 new HIV cases last year in 15 West Virginia counties, 14 of which the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention consider to be the most susceptible to an outbreak.
We've debated on whether we want to put a harm reduction sticker on the side of the van. At this point, we just want to keep it a plain van.
Keeping a low profile is important. The county's health department is in Pineville, the county seat. It's a half hour away, and that's a long drive here. And the department is next to the courthouse. Rebecca says no one using drugs would want to get clean needles there.
No drug addict's going to want to do that.
The health department staff chose the two locations they currently drive to based on the at-risk populations living there. They tried another small community first, Alpoca. That's where Christy Seaton says her parents live.
There's no police force there. It's kind of in a rural area. The police response time when you call for any other issue is kind of a long time. And if there happened to be an issue there, you know, it might take the police force a little while to get there. Some of the people that are using this program you know, are not the kind of people you want in your neighborhood.
Seaton's a councilwoman in Mullins, a city in Wyoming County. She believes in the needle exchange and even suggested the health department move it to her town. But she has some concerns about the two current locations.
I just think if they're going to offer that program, maybe it should be somewhere more in the public and not so much in the rural communities, which I know that's what they're trying to focus on. But I just think it needs to be thought of better.
Cox says there haven't been any safety issues. Needle exchange sites have been controversial in West Virginia, but at least two nonprofits already operate mobile harm reduction programs elsewhere, and a third is expected to start later this year. Later that July afternoon, Cox and his team drive to Long Branch, an especially rural part of the county, 40 minutes from the health department. It's sweltering as they pull in the parking lot. People are outside walking around and rocking on chairs on a nearby porch. They're staring at the van. It's the van's first time here, and Cox has to start by building trust. He walks over to the porch and explains, before they even fully set up, why they're here. Here's an example of how he talks to people.
And our ultimate goal, to be honest with you, is if hope at some point in time you decide that you'd like to get into recovery, we would hope that you would do that at some point. And we want to make you healthy, or keep you healthy enough long enough to do that. Does that make sense? You need to engage folks. Let them know why you're there, and let them know that there's nothing to fear. And that's the message that I delivered.
With Fred Cox are Gina Carter and Crystal Simpson, both nurses at the health department. They can do hepatitis C and HIV tests on site. One woman here gets a blood test and the answer to a question that has nagged her for a long time, whether her previous drug use left her with any chronic infections.
We've always wondered. I could have cried when I found out it was negative.
She didn't know what to make of the van at first.
It's got a bad drug reputation. You can talk to anybody and they'll tell you Long Branch. At Long Branch, get what you want. There's some really good people here, and this program would help a lot of people.
It would help?
A lot. Because a lot of these people really don't have the money to go buy new needles. So that right there would help quit spreading diseases.
As of last week, they've served 50 people, and starting this fall, Wyoming will share the van with some nearby counties. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Molly Bourne in Wyoming County.
We're going to take a quick break. Still to come, we'll learn why residents in one community in Kentucky were first opposed to a needle exchange program and what made them change their minds. And we'll hear about why the needle exchange program in West Virginia's capital city was recently shut down by the city's mayor. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We'll be right back.
Inside Appalachia is supported in part by the West Virginia Food and Farm Coalition, helping farmers share their food with your family every week at your local farmers market. Local market locations available at farmfreshwv.com.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Intravenous drug use is central to the current conversation about HIV in Appalachia. But of course, the LGBTQ community has been dealing with the ravages of this disease for generations. And a new report from the CDC identifies 40 new HIV cases in southern West Virginia. Of these cases, researchers found that 60% were transmitted by male-to-male sexual contact. But what the study says is that because of the opioid epidemic, these cases could have led to a massive HIV outbreak if it hadn't been caught in time. Increasing testing and surveillance for HIV is one of their recommendations for how communities can better prevent outbreaks of these diseases in the future. Producer Roxy Todd headed to Mercer County, West Virginia, to meet some of the people who are working on the front lines of this problem and managing to have a little bit of fun while they're at it.
Loud music pours out of a historic church in downtown Bluefield, West Virginia, around 7 on a Friday evening. 30 people are eating barbecue, beans, and chicken for a newly formed LGBTQ support group. As the guests grab their food and have a seat, a man stands inside the echoey church to talk.
Now, you all got your goodie bags.
His name is Daryl Kennedy, and he isn't a preacher. He's the executive director of a nonprofit called South Central Educational Development, which has its headquarters inside this old church building. Tonight's event is aimed at adults, though there is one high school student in attendance. Kennedy passes around goodie bags full of condoms and information about how to prevent sexually transmitted diseases.
Read the information in them. It's good. We provided you with tons of condoms and lubrication. Safe sex is the best sex.
As you can hear, the atmosphere in the room is different from a doctor's office. People are laughing, singing along. One person, a drag queen, gets up to dance, and the room erupts in applause. Kennedy is hosting this meeting as a way to talk with the LGBTQ community about the increasing risk of hepatitis and HIV in southern West Virginia and other parts of Appalachia. The risks are increasing because of high rates of drug use combined with poor access to health care. On this night, Kennedy's organization is also hosting free HIV testing here in the church building.
And prevention is number one. I think you got to catch it before it starts. So if you're not doing anything preventative, when you have an outbreak, you can't say, how did that happen? You know how it happened. You didn't do anything to stop it.
Someone who agrees with Kennedy is Dr. Gordon Smith, a professor at the West Virginia University School of Public Health, who is studying the risk of an outbreak of HIV in southern West Virginia.
Unfortunately, because the testing is so poor, we could be right in the middle of it and we wouldn't even know it.
Smith's team received a $1 million grant last year from the Centers for Disease Control and the Appalachian Regional Commission to help increase surveillance and prevention of HIV and hepatitis C in southern West Virginia. The other lead researcher with the project is Dr. Judith Feinberg.
You know, ideally, it should have been done 5 years ago, because at the very least, you could have prevented HIV and you could have also curtailed the spread of hepatitis C.
Feinberg says her group plans on partnering with community-based organizations, like Kennedy's organization in Bluefield, to do more testing and outreach. Kennedy says he's on board with the partnership, but he's concerned that the WVU researchers are not going to fund his organization's efforts.
We're not staffed large enough to actively go out and address this head-on with the community as we used to do.
Kennedy used to do more HIV testing and prevention in southern West Virginia. But then, in 2009, his organization lost funding it had been getting from the Department of Health and Human Resources to do HIV prevention. It wasn't just his organization. About 10 years ago, the CDC began reducing funding for prevention and surveillance of HIV in states with a low number of people with the disease. States like West Virginia took some of the biggest cuts. One result has been the reduction of resources available for local community-based organizations like South Central, says Dr. Raul Gupta, commissioner of DHHR's Bureau for Public Health.
Since 2009, HIV prevention in West Virginia has seen a reduction of about $1 million from the CDC.
In a statement, the CDC said, quote, most funding is directed to the prevention activities that are most likely to have significant and lasting results on the HIV epidemic, end quote. But that strategy doesn't always work to prevent unexpected outbreaks.
It was actually a pretty big surprise that we heard about what was going on in Scott County.
This is Dr. John Brooks, a researcher with the CDC's Division of HIV/AIDS Prevention. Back in 2015, Scott County, Indiana, an area that hadn't previously been a high-prevalence area, experienced a massive HIV outbreak.
We marshaled an enormous amount of resources to really better, not only to try and stop the outbreak from growing, and then to also better understand what happened there and how we can prevent it from happening elsewhere.
Brooks was one of the lead authors of a CDC study that concluded many of the nation's most vulnerable counties are in Appalachia. Now, in order to prevent more unexpected outbreaks, Brooks says they're looking at shifting more of their funding back to rural communities because the opioid epidemic is creating a higher risk here. Next year, West Virginia will be receiving an 18% increase for HIV prevention and surveillance as part of a new effort by the CDC. It will be the first increase in funding for HIV prevention the state has seen in 10 years. Exactly how much this funding will trickle down to community-based organizations, though, is unknown. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Roxy Todd.
Health officials say the stigma associated with HIV can add to the risk of widespread outbreaks. If someone keeps the fact of their disease a secret or sees an HIV/AIDS test as a source of shame or embarrassment and therefore remains undiagnosed, the problem only gets worse. Roxy Todd visited with some residents of Southern West Virginia who have HIV or AIDS to find out what it's like to live with the stigma of a taboo disease.
Carl was in his senior year at Concord University in Mercer County, West Virginia, when he had some routine blood work done during a hospital admission. That's how he learned.
They found out that I was infected with HIV.
He thinks he contracted the disease from a same-sex partner. Even though he used protection, he says his partner was careless one time. He says it's been a struggle telling people he has HIV because of the stigma against people with the disease. We're using his first name only because Carl still hasn't told everyone in his family.
I have two people out of my entire family that know.
Even among some doctors, Carl says, he encounters homophobia. He recalls an early visit to a doctor in nearby Beckley.
She, in so many words, said, "Well, if I were you, I wouldn't have done the actions to get this." And that set me back. That sent me spiraling that a medical professional that deals with these infections would be so crass to somebody that was so mentally fragile anyway, because I just got that diagnosis.
Carl stopped taking his medication for a few days. He says he almost gave up. Then he contacted the Ryan White program at Charleston Area Medical Center, where he now makes the 2-hour round-trip drive for checkups. The stigma against people with HIV and AIDS can have a huge impact in rural communities. It affects what treatment options are available and makes it difficult for health officials to respond quickly to a possible outbreak. Tanya Basta, who chairs the Health Sciences College at Ohio University, has done research on the effects of stigma in rural Appalachia.
There are providers who, in rural areas, unfortunately, are still stigmatizing against their patients. And
West Virginia does not have a high number of people with HIV or AIDS. But researchers like Basta worry there could be undiagnosed cases, especially in the rural areas of the state.
Testing is an issue, and I'm not saying that stigma is necessarily any higher in rural areas. It's just that because of the nature of living in small towns where everybody kind of knows everybody, word travels quickly.
Few people living with HIV or AIDS in southern West Virginia are willing to tell their stories in public. Elena Imes is one of them. She has lived with the disease for 18 years. For many years before the disease progressed, Imes says she did not know she had been infected by her husband. She worries that there are many undiagnosed cases in her community.
Part of the problem is the negativity of the disease itself and the fear and the stereotyping. If you got AIDS, you probably did something bad, Christianly bad. They don't want anybody to see them go take a test. Consequently, people don't go take the test.
She's told her story to the media several times, but speaking out has caused some backlash. A few years ago, she experienced an incident where she worked at Walmart. A woman recognized her from a TV news story and knew that she had AIDS.
I know you're from the TV. You're killing us all.
The woman yelled this in the parking lot, drawing a crowd. She accused Imes of infecting people with HIV by touching things when she stocked the shelves.
I'm sorry. I don't really like telling people because that hurts so bad. So embarrassed. And that woman really thought she was warning everybody.
Imes lives in a small wooden house in Cole City in Raleigh County, where she runs a small animal rescue service. As we step through the front door, pink curtains and a thin layer of frayed plastic covers holes in her windows. When I visited, she wore 5 layers of clothes indoors to keep warm. She weighs less than 80 pounds. Her health is deteriorating, and she's struggling to get by.
Financially, I'm in ruin.
She doesn't work at Walmart anymore. That's partly because a few years ago, she lost her mode of transportation. One night, she tried to hitchhike to work and was raped. Her perpetrators were never caught. Now she worries that those who raped her are unintentionally spreading the disease. As I listened to her story and Carl's, I wondered, why do they stay where they are? Im says one reason is because she wants to stay and help other people who have the disease.
I would tell them that the worst thing they can do is to keep it a secret. If you can toughen up, you need to share it. Be open about it. That's the problem. If more people were open, then the stigma wouldn't be there.
Because she's been in the media telling her story, over the years, IMS has become almost a one-woman support system for people here who have HIV. That's something Carl says people need more of.
The biggest fear that someone with this has, this infection has, is doing it alone. And that often causes you to become depressed because you are lonely.
I asked him if he ever thinks about leaving home, moving to a bigger city.
I would rather live here and put up a front than move somewhere and be myself. I know that sounds kind of odd, but I do love this place. It is a beautiful place.
Although he is worried that his friends and family will find out he has HIV after the story airs, Carl says it's worth the risk because he hopes telling his story might help someone decide to get tested for HIV. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Roxy Todd in Beckley, West Virginia.
Today on Inside Appalachia, we're hearing about the growing concern over outbreaks of diseases associated with needle drug use in central Appalachia. These increased public health threats are partially due to the region's ongoing opioid crisis. To address these threats, some Appalachian communities are turning to needle exchange programs, which are designed to decrease the sharing of infected needles among drug users. In Appalachia, needle exchange programs don't come without controversy. The programs have a stigma that comes from the belief that such programs enable or even encourage drug use instead of imposing penalties on users. But supporters say that needle exchanges, especially when coupled with addiction treatment options for participants, can help pull people out of their addictive behaviors and get them on a path to recovery. It is possible for opinions on this issue to shift and minds to change, especially when the issue is personalized and drug users are seen as human sufferers rather than moral failures. But some do see addiction as a moral issue, and needle exchange programs can challenge some deeply held spiritual convictions. Mary Meehan went to Powell County, Kentucky last year to look at how the opioid crisis forced a religious community to reconsider some of its beliefs.
Dirty needles clatter into a safe container. That's the main point of a needle exchange. But addicts using this service also get the overdose drug naloxone, info on treatment, and testing for HIV and hepatitis C. Addicts like Allie, who at 24 has been injecting heroin for 4 years. She's been a client at the Lexington Fayette County Health Department for about 6 months.
Well, at first, the first few weeks I came, I wasn't sure that I had hep C. But I actually just got the test done, and it came up positive. I just found that out 5 minutes ago. I relapsed. I lost my job. I had to move out of my parents' house all within 48 hours. I just fell hard.
In the spring of 2015, there was an HIV outbreak of nearly 200 in Austin, Indiana, population 4,200. That sent legislators in Ohio, West Virginia, and Kentucky scrambling to pass laws allowing local health departments to create needle exchange programs.
There is movement in this state and a lot of other states to do some things differently.
That's the head of the Kentucky Office of Drug Control Policy, Van Ingram. He says there's a fundamental shifting toward viewing drug abuse as an illness rather than a crime.
Certainly when it comes to drug traffickers, that's what we're set up to do. We can handle that in criminal justice. But to treat a disease in criminal justice, it's not been very effective.
Lindsay McGar works for the Fayette County Needle Exchange. People there were concerned about violence at the exchange site, a flood of needles going out into the community, an uptick in heroin use. That hasn't happened.
Nobody wakes up one day and says, I want to be a drug addict. One of the things that people say the most when they come in is that they're so ashamed, they're so embarrassed, they want help, but addiction is so powerful.
But that's a tough sell in Appalachia. Just ask Powell County Public Health Nurse Mandy Watson.
When it first started, I actually called several of my friends and told them, I was like, pray about this. Do not let this happen. You know, pray that it will not happen here.
Physician assistant Troy Brooks also wasn't interested.
Why would we give drug addicts easier access
to use their drug of choice.
But then Brooks listened to the concerns of a local cop. The officer fears infection from getting stuck by discarded needles he stows in a plastic bottle.
But he went out to the Clay City playground. I think he collected 41 needles that had been stashed around different places on the playground. That put me over the edge.
Pastor Brad Epperson oversees play practice at the Clay City First Church of God, the first brick building off the Mountain Parkway. For Epperson, addiction is a disease with a moral underpinning. That made it a challenge for him to embrace anything that looked like support of drug abuse. After all, cancer patients don't steal from Mama to pay for chemo. Diabetics don't infect their spouses. Still, he knew something had to change.
You know, I listened to the projections for what HIV and hepatitis would do here in our community. I really did have to reevaluate and say maybe I've been a little quick to judge here.
Soon, Watson, Brooks, and Epperson were helping others change their minds. Last fall, the Powell County Fiscal Court, the Board of Health, and the Stanton City Council unanimously supported a needle exchange program starting in January. Watson, who once prayed to stop the exchange, now has a very different prayer request.
And the more I learned about it and realized what the program was truly about, I was calling them all back saying, pray that we do get it. Our community is not going to have anything left if we don't stop and take our community back. They can't quit. They can't put it down because their body won't let them. I think it's just a matter of having somebody there who can relate and say, you know, I see what you're going through. You need help. Let me show you where you can go to do that when you're ready.
Epperson says helping addicts is an extension of God's love.
They're made in the image of God. They're highly redeemable. I believe that with all my heart. And I don't believe that we can stand by and just say, well, we're going to give up on them. That's not what we need to do as a community.
That's the pull for Allie in Lexington. Clean needles draw her there, but compassion keeps her coming back.
I don't feel judged. I will continue to come back until I am finished with recovery.
For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Mary Meehan in Clay City, Kentucky.
That story originally aired in January 2017. Today we're asking communities across Central Appalachia what they're doing to prevent an outbreak of needle-borne diseases. The CDC recommends that communities at risk should offer needle exchange programs, which helped Scott County, Indiana, slow the spread of HIV and AIDS, and has also been shown to help encourage some drug abusers to seek addiction treatment. Between 2013 and 2017, the number of needle exchange programs increased from 1 to over 50 in Kentucky, North Carolina, and West Virginia. But as we'll hear in this next story, needle exchange programs are not one size fits all, and not every program is implemented equally. That's what residents of Charleston, West Virginia, found out earlier this year when their city's program went up against resistance from the city's police chief, mayor, and some town residents. Eventually, it was suspended completely. John Law, spokesperson for the Kanawha Charleston Health Department, says what isn't as visible could be just as dangerous, bloodborne diseases like hepatitis and HIV.
What people don't see, and they may not see immediately, are the illnesses that using dirty needles calls in the population.
So Law's department set out to implement a needle exchange program in Charleston. Drug users could bring in a maximum of 30 dirty needles and exchange them for 30 new, clean ones. Programs like this are often part of what's referred to as a harm reduction program.
We often think of the people who use needles and the people who inject drugs as those unfortunate individuals we see huddled in doorways and sleeping on the street. And those people have a high drug usage, but it's also people who work in restaurants and secretaries and people who work in all facets of life who came through the harm reduction program and realized that they needed clean needles to stave off another health problem besides their addiction.
While needle exchange programs have been proven to lower the rates of bloodborne illnesses like HIV and hepatitis, they are also meant to help addicts find treatment and provide them with basic medical care. They can also generate data to help medical practitioners track the program's effectiveness. The original program started with just 5 people in December 2015. Eventually, 6,000 individuals visited 24,000 times. The health department distributed 650,000 needles and collected about 425,000 needles. That leaves about 225,000 needles unaccounted for. Law says these missing needles were never turned back in, so when dirty needles were found on the streets, it was a mystery just where it came from. First responders, like the city police chief, said needles were found in public places and accused drug users of leaving exposed needles in their clothing during pat-downs.
And there were excess needles there. Everybody realizes that. We are certainly not denying that. We went out on several times with city officials. There were needles on the street, but there are needles on the street all over the country because we have an opioid crisis, not because we have a needle exchange, but because we have an opioid crisis. There were large numbers of needles found in abandoned residences where people had broken in and were staying. We also have a homeless crisis. We have a homeless problem that needs addressing. I think the needles were a symptom of that, but not the cause of that.
As a result of the outcry over the excess needles, the police chief issued a list of recommendations to address the program's flaws. But because some of the suggestions were difficult to implement, the city decided to suspend the program altogether in March. One of the problematic recommendations was to require participants to show photo ID, which law says is impractical.
Many of the people that we deal with are homeless or don't have photo IDs, so we need to work around that. Another requirement was to require testing. Borders on being unethical, or it is unethical to require testing of people. We strongly encourage it, but it can't be a quid pro quo.
Law says the health department has a responsibility to take best practices seriously, but it is continuing to evaluate the recommendations to see if the department can successfully implement them. Despite the public outcry and the program suspension, Law says he still considers it a success.
We measure success because the hepatitis rate in Kanawha County just declined. It was a slight decline, but it declined slightly. And we know anecdotally from our recovery coaches who were there and part of the harm reduction clinic that we had more than 100, probably closer to 150 people enter recovery. So that was very gratifying.
Law says the program was a national model that was used other places like Huntington, West Virginia.
I think if we failed, we were probably not quick enough to respond to concerns that were expressed, because it was a nationally reviewed and nationally modeled program. We were following best practices. That being said, and it's what we're doing now, you need to listen very closely to the people in your community, and you have to do what is right for your community at the time. Each community is different, and each program is going to have to be tweaked a little bit on site.
Law says the exchange program is important to public health, and the department will continue to look into implementing the Charleston Police Chief's recommendations. Shortly after our interview with Law, the West Virginia DHHR released results of an investigation into the program. The DHHR listed 6 items in the report that were problematic, including missed opportunities for linking users with treatment, messy data entry, and a lack of an oversight committee. They also concluded that the Charleston-Kanawha Health Department's Harm Reduction Syringe Services Program certification be suspended until some of their recommendations can be implemented. The Charleston Police Chief did not return our request for comment. Current Mayor Danny Jones would not grant us an interview, but he's spoken out frequently against the program. Jones recently spoke with Robin Young on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR about why he felt so strongly about this issue.
Well, it became we have 2 needle exchanges in Charleston. One is operated by HealthRight, and they have 150 patients, and it's operated in a fashion that is correct. And they did so well, they operated under the radar. We didn't even know they were doing it. Then the Kanawha Charleston Health Department got in the business, and they just basically became a mill. And they were giving out 40,000 to 50,000 needles in a month. Now, if you go through 400 patients in one day, then there's no way you can check their blood before you give them the needles to find out if they have any disease before you give them the needles.
Well, but the health advocates who are backing this, first of all, they said they didn't expect, you know, this huge explosion, and it speaks to just how bad this crisis is. But you're right. They had 483 drug users pass through in just 8 hours one day. This is, you know, you only got, 50,000 people there. And they say that speaks to the need for people coming in to get these clean needles.
Well, except they came from 190 different zip codes. And we became a hub of activity. Now, to get the money to buy the drugs, the drug users have to break into somebody's car or cause crimes. Since we became a mecca for these folks, it wasn't a needle exchange, it was a needle mill, and crime in this city skyrocketed. So what we did was we imposed some rules on them that they had to live with that were very similar to the health right rules. They couldn't live with them. They shut it down. And now the crime has gone way down in Charleston, West Virginia, because we were able to close that needle operation.
Well, let's talk about what your rules were. An ID requirement so that people who were coming to get these clean needles had to prove that they lived in the county, picture ID. They had to be tested for hepatitis and HIV. That would be mandatory. Needles would only be dispensed on a strict one-for-one trade so that there wouldn't be any extras that people could maybe sell. But you all know that, you know, advocates, healthcare advocates, say that the ID in particular was prohibitive. Homeless people make up a huge population of these addicts. They don't have IDs. And the idea of limiting the clean needles, you know, means that maybe somebody can't give a clean needle to somebody who might need it. So you've got maybe another dirty needle being used. But I hear your point as well, that this was not only attracting this population, but it was in a place where you had just built a beautiful civic center, a $100 million development, and you hope to revitalize the city through that.
And this health department was just, it's a half a block away. The Civic Center hadn't been finished yet, but it became basically a mini mall for drugs. And if the drug dealers knew when the needles were going to be dispensed, when they were going to be given out, and that was all day on Wednesday, then the drug dealers were waiting in the shadows, and they were all through the neighborhood to sell drugs to the people that needed the drugs to put in the needles, that they just had to break into somebody's car to get the money to pay the drug dealer. Since we shut down the Kanawha Charleston Health Department, or since they shut down their own needle operation, crime has dropped precipitously.
But what happens to the addicts?
Perhaps they went back to wherever they came from, maybe one of those 190 zip codes, or they could go down to HealthRight, where the entrance is a little more cumbersome, but they would be more likely to get into recovery, and they would be tested for disease before they go in. I don't know how you can quantify whether a person has hep C if you don't test them for it before you give them the needles.
Well, a couple things. A lot of bruised feelings in your city. There are people who feel that they were removed from certain committees because they weren't going to vote the right way. There are police and fire officers who are feeling like they aren't respected by the healthcare people because, as you said, there are concerns about the needles that are still around. You are retiring. And it feels like leaving a lot of bruised feelings behind.
I'm on the side of the policemen and the firefighters and it's not just
from. But this is your health department.
It's from city council members, and some people that are members of the board of the health department. One of which is a council member and is a leading advocate for this. The doctor that started all this is no longer there. Mm-hmm. He became drug czar for the state. We're for Charleston, and we're going to advocate for it. And we would suggest that anybody that wants to be involved in a needle exchange go down to HealthRight. They have 25,000 patients there.
Well, I hear what you're saying. Is one solution to encourage other counties, other zip codes, to also have maybe smaller needle exchanges? In other words, have more of them. Don't put them next to a gleaming, you know, civic center that understandably is supposed to draw tourists and business to the area. Have smaller ones, but more of them outside the city?
You know, I'm sure you can find many academics that think this is a good idea, but it certainly didn't work out there near Angel Stadium in Southern California. And there are places they're shutting down around the country, and I wouldn't recommend it to anybody.
Well, but you had a son who had a heroin problem, so obviously you care about this issue.
Of course I care.
So what can be done? I mean, clean needles are valuable.
If you really want to know, I mean, the drug companies got us into this mess when they flooded this state of all states with millions of these pills. So then they shut the pill mills down. They put the doctors in jail. They shut down the drug stores. And there was no plan B for the drug addicts. And that expense and whatever needs to be done for these folks should be incurred and paid for by the people that caused it. And if that meant that you would have prescribed drugs to wean people off that was administered by a hospital, that's something worthy of having a conversation about.
That's what you want, prescription heroin, for instance?
I would look at it. Yeah. I mean, I think that's if we're going to have a conversation about something, I mean, that's something that would open up a dialogue about something reasonable. Don't just give them the vessel and let them have to go out and buy it illegally. I mean, this should be handled by professionals. And if the academics really want to push something, maybe this could be experimented with around the country.
Yeah. How did your son, I mean, heroin's vicious. How did
he recover? I believe it started, without exposing myself to liability here, it started in his home, in the environment he was raised in, and it wasn't by me. I was not married to his mother, and in the environment where he was born in, drugs were readily available. And he told me later on that he started using drugs at a very early age. And then he had teeth problems, and he was able to get some pain medication. Mm. And I think he was off to the races then.
How did he stop?
Well, he stopped because he kept going to jail. I had him arrested twice. I have 160 police officers that work for me. And the last time, though, it wasn't police in this county. It was police in another county. And this is the third time he's been in front of a judge to plead guilty. But he's in recovery now, and he is, as I understand, he's doing okay. He's 28 years old. But you reach a point as a father of an addict, you can't let your whole world become a set of dominoes. Because you have a son, life goes on for all of us. And I'll tell you, jail saved his life, which is sad.
And even though you wouldn't want your son to contract these diseases like HIV or hepatitis,
I don't know that he hasn't, Robin.
Well, but
I don't know that I don't know if he has or not.
But a clean needle,
I'm not willing to sacrifice a whole city to get involved in that enterprise. That's no way to tackle this. You don't sacrifice a whole city over this.
That was Charleston, West Virginia Mayor Danny Jones speaking with Here and Now's Robin Young. We reached out to the Charleston Police Department to ask them about the crime statistics that Danny Jones mentioned in that interview, but we weren't able to verify that the crime rates were affected by the closing of the needle exchange. It's true, unfortunately, that there are still people who think that people suffering from addiction should be left to die, to clean up the streets, as they say. But if we've learned anything from this situation, it's that we can't let extreme views polarize our ideas of what's best for our communities. We have to learn to listen to each other better, because both sides have legitimate concerns. When Mayor Danny Jones spoke out against the program, some groups and community members were quick to defend it and assumed that it was a stigma against drug users or lack of education about addiction that turned people off about the program. But the Bureau for Public Health investigation showed that there were indeed some real issues with the way the program was implemented. When we let the facts speak for themselves, it often stings a little on both political sides, but that's when true breakthroughs seem to happen. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from the Ohio Valley Resource, WBUR in Boston, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky, WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky, and WOUB in Athens, Ohio. Music in today's show was provided by Dinosaur Burps, Michael Howard, and Ben Townsend. Roxy Todd is our producer. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. Catherine Moore edited our show this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. Molly Bourne is our web editor. You can find us online on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Or address your letters to Inside Appalachia at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. If you'd like to listen to any part of this episode again, don't forget you can subscribe or download all of our stories on iTunes, Downcast, wvpublic.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.